Glenn, how are you?
Hey, Josh, I'm all right. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. It's been a while since we've spoken.
A long while, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. Not that much has happened in the world. Just billions of gallons of oil spilling into the Gulf of Mexico since the last time we talked. And
Turkish flotillas upsetting the apple cart in Gaza.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and everything in between.
And everything
and
in
Afghanistan,
between.
This McChrystal thing, and
the
strategy coming into deep question, and the withdrawal date becoming very, very uncertain.
Yeah.
And the G20 or G8 or whatever trying to coordinate fiscal policy, and the huge debate about should we have austerity and get budgets in line, or Should we spend more and avoid the recession? And can these governments coordinate their policy? And Germany, what's their problem in all of this?
Yeah, well, let's start with something simpler, maybe. I'm taking a break from listening to the Elena Kagan hearings.
Elena Kagan, yes.
Have this conversation with you. I don't know if you've been watching them.
I've watched off and on, but not religiously, Josh.
Not so assiduously. Yeah. Well, I may be a sucker for this, but I think they've been pretty good. I mean, just personally, I think. This is a case of somebody who's got, you know, obviously a very impressive resume, but then when you watch her perform, you can understand the strengths of the resume and of her reputation.
Can we talk about the resume for a minute? Because I'm not intimately familiar with it either, but
yeah.
She's not really a scholar, right? And she's not really a litigator, right?
She has never been on the bench.
Has she written an important scholarly, legal scholarly article?
She's written some pretty important stuff about administrative law.
Okay.
She's, when I say the resume, I mean that she's the first woman solicitor general, that she was the first woman dean of Harvard Law School, and she has a very good reputation as in the field of administrative law. There's not a huge scholarly track record, but there is the scholarship in administrative law, which is obviously a very important area of law.
I'm not putting her down by any means.
I don't want to be misunderstood, but
I really want to know. So
yeah.
Scalia, then, you think of Scalia as a heavyweight, okay? I mean, again, I can be wrong about this. Correct me. I'm not as con law an expert as I imagine you to be.
Yeah.
But you think about, in terms of the battle of ideas, you know, doctrine, you know, kind of fighting it out.
Right.
I can imagine that there would have been liberal legal thinkers who would have been somehow more formidable in this battle of ideas, again, with due respect to soon-to-be Justice Kagan.
Yes.
You don't appoint them because they've actually written something down, and then there would be a big argument, and they could be caricatured.
Right. Right.
You end up with those kinds of people. I don't know what the Lawrence tribes of the world of a different generation, or
court. My colleague Pam Carlin is a very distinguished constitutional
law
scholar.
Yes, I know of her.
She was somebody who was on whether it was the top five or the top ten or the top different people's list, but she was certainly somebody whose name was in play, and I think people who wanted somebody who would mark out a poll on the liberal end of the court had a preference for Pam Carlin, although I don't think she was ever as a strong a candidate as Diane Wood, for example, who also arguably had more of a would have marked out more of a poll, but. Kagan is what's come across in the hearings is what everyone says about her. First, that she is intellectually formidable. This is a very smart person.
Okay.
She doesn't have a big track record of defining a position on constitutional interpretation. That's not been her main area for that, frankly. But but also somebody who is, just personally speaking, very funny. She's gotten off a lot of good lines.
Yeah, I saw some also, of them reprised.
Yeah, yeah. But also, I think, you know, her reputation at the, you know, very divided Harvard Law School is as somebody who's capable of listening hard and bringing people together. And I think one of the things that I felt as I was listening to the hearings yesterday and some this morning is that she's pretty good at making everybody in the room look good, not just herself. It's a real skill, and making people look good even when they're taking the unhappy position of trying to tar her as a legal thinker and as a potential judge because of her association with Thurgood Marshall, as if that were a bad thing. But I think on the on the substance of what the conversation has been about, and not just her personal performance. There was one exchange that I thought was particularly good when she and Senator Cornyn went back and forth some. And I think she pushed, this hasn't really gotten much play, but I think she pushed back pretty hard against an originalist interpretation of the Constitution, focused in particular on the 14th Amendment. She has repeatedly in the hearings emphasized the importance of the fact that the Constitution is not just is not like a rule book with a bunch of specific clauses, like the president has to be over 35 years old and born in the country, but it also has very general clauses, open-ended clauses, like the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, for example, or for that matter, the First Amendment speech and religion clauses, or the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. These are all clauses that invite interpretation, and the originalist view is that the right way to interpret those is in terms of how they would have been understood by people at the time that they were enacted. And she said, essentially, this is a kind of standard argument, but she pushed it pretty hard, that if you thought about the 14th Amendment that way, the requirement of providing equal protection, that you would have had to come out on the other side of in Brown versus Board of Education, because at the time that the 14th Amendment was enacted, schools were racially segregated and public facilities
were
racially
segregated.
That's
not a very original point. I've heard that.
I think
that point came up during Robert Bork's hearings, didn't it, or something?
It's not an right. So here's what I thought was interesting about it was that it's not at all an original point. It is the standard, but first of all, it raises a real difficulty for originalists, and originalism has not diminished in importance since the Bork hearings. I would say. There's the kind of, joking references to how we're all originalists now. Originalism has grown in strength over the past, 3 years since the Bork hearings. But also, I thought that what was interesting about it was that she kept on pushing this point in the conversation with Cornyn, even though she didn't have to. So the context of the argument with Cornyn, she could have taken a much narrower point of view in responding to what he said.
Yeah.
But she really wanted to make sure that this point came across, that the right way to interpret the open-ended clauses of the Constitution is not in originalist terms. Another thing that I thought that I think has been pretty interesting in the hearings is the kind of stylized way that that the discussion about the Supreme Court and judges generally in the Constitution has gone for some time now is that there's a strong desire to have, on the conservatives say that they want judges who interpret the law, who don't make the law, who are modest, who show a lot of humility, who don't come up with sweeping new ideas about what the Constitution says. And what I think was most interesting about in the discussions that she had both with Cornyn and with Senator Coburn is they are very they don't want a modest judiciary. They want judges who will keep elected officials from doing bad stuff. They want judges who will keep elected officials from making gun regulations. They want judges who will keep elected officials from passing big health care bills. They don't want courts to be deferential on issues like campaign finance. These are not guys who are celebrating
Josh,
the wisdom.
I don't understand this point that you're making. I mean,
yeah.
If a law is unconstitutional, the reason you have a court is so the court can strike it down. Anybody who
right.
thinks laws are unconstitutional wants their courts to strike them down.
Right.
That's just wanting
right.
the court to do its job, not flip-flopping on your conception of the court. I don't understand.
Yeah, so Glenn, you know, what you say is, of course, true, that if you come to the conclusion that a law is unconstitutional, then it's your job description that you strike it down. What's not part of your the more controversial part of the job of judicial interpretation is to try to determine when a law is unconstitutional, and in particular when you have very sweeping constitutional clauses, like, for example, the Due Process Clause or the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, or the First Amendment protections of speech or freedom of religion, free exercise of religion, or the ban on religious establishments. These are clauses that invite interpretation. And the recent argument on part of the more people who are more conservative has been that courts, judges generally, courts in particular, have been too willing to interfere with, you know, the good work of democracy and elected representatives. That's been particularly true in the area of abortion choice, where the position has generally been that the court should be more deferential to efforts to regulate in that area. What I think is striking in this hearing is that there's a very powerful hostility to judicial deference, and in that respect, there's a very strong position on the part of some people in the Senate, as a jurisprudential position, that's very resonant with where the court was in the first part of the 20th century. So in the first part of the 20th century, between 1905 and 1937, the Supreme Court, seven times a year, overturned economic regulation passed either by state legislatures or by the federal government. This is the so-called Lochner era, and it only ended in 1937, some people say, in response to the threat of court packing by President Roosevelt, when the court stepped into line with New Deal economic regulation. But for the previous three decades, the court had stood pretty steadfastly against economic regulation. The position of a bunch of people in the hearings, the conservative Republicans in the hearings, is in essence that they really would like a return to that period of jurisprudence. They are not looking for a court that's deferential to legislation.
Now, I have to tell you, as someone who was trained in mathematics as an undergraduate and is a social scientist, when I hear the lawyers parse these points that you're just saying now, you know, when...
Yeah.
And when not has a court been an activist court? And what are the theories of interpretation that justify any particular ruling? I think, people are reaching results, and then they need a way of justifying and rationalizing how they reach the result. The other guy, that is the guy that reaches results that I don't like, always has an illegitimate way of justifying it. Of course, have a self-evidently legitimate way of justifying it, and yet I can't really find objective criteria for sorting out these arguments. It always has a whose ox is gored feel to it, and it lacks a rigor and kind of sort of clarity of the justification, as far as I can tell. Is that just my ignorance or what?
No, that's why they don't put mathematicians and economists on the Supreme Court.
Let me ask you something. This is apropos of nothing in particular, Josh. We didn't vet this subject before I'm bringing it up now, but I'm really struck in the context of the debate about BP,
mm-hmm.
and the oil spill and liability and a $20 billion fund for compensating and who's going to pay for the cleanup. I'm really struck by the way in which the political dynamic is making relative the property claims that are at stake. It feels a little bit to me like nationalizing a company. Not entirely, not expropriating their assets. Not like, you know, in the Latin American case where you run the gringos out of town. You know, you take over the oil fields, you seize the utility company, and it becomes the property of the Venezuelan people. Not quite like that.
Yeah.
But a little bit like, you know, the political easing over into the sphere of what had heretofore been a kind of pristine, you know, clean property thing where you got the profits, you paid the royalties, you bought the insurance, you paid off your employees, and you took the dividends to the bank. And a little bit like, we are the sovereign, we'll seize your assets if it comes to that. I'm not asking you, I'm telling you, this is what you're going to do with your funds. Now, do you share that sense of how this environmental disaster and the liabilities and costs that are associated with it and the unclear lines? I think they are rather unclear. I mean, when members of Congress start saying, don't pay your bondholders, I heard somebody say that.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, the people who hold bonds have a contract. If BP is not supposed to recognize those claims in front of paying off the people who have been harmed by the oil spill, what other claims is BP not supposed to discharge before the funds are made available to the people who have been harmed by the oil spill? For example, what about their employees? I mean, when the president said, I'm going to not ask them, not negotiate with them, I'm going to inform them that they're going to establish a $20 billion fund, which of course they are more or less happy to do under the circumstances, and I'm not saying I'm against that, but I'm just thinking, you know, that was a kind of imposition, perhaps not unreasonable, perhaps not unjustified, but nevertheless a kind of imposition that had a quasi political seizing of private assets feel to it. To me,
you know, I'm not saying it's wrong.
I'm not saying anything controversial. I'm just observing. I'm observing that the politics, and the property, and the private, and the political, that they're kind of mixed in together, and that the oil spill throws that in a sharp relief.
Yes, I agree with you that they're mixed in together. I think, you know, when you say that requiring BP to compensate people who it has injured by its let's stipulate for the sake of argument, you know, by its reckless conduct. I mean, you're not denying that the conduct was reckless. You're just so. But and you say, well, this seems like a seizure of assets. I'm sorry, you sound to me like Rand Paul when Rand Paul says that if you have to serve African Americans in your private restaurant, that is a kind of seizure of your seizure of your assets.
Yeah, I heard him.
And it is. It's a, you know, look. It's and it's that's actually the two things are connected, because that is how the Supreme Court used to argue in the early part of the 20th century.
Let's explore this.
You'd invoke an abstraction, you know, this very sweeping abstraction about property, and you'd say, well, you know, any kind of regulation of it is the equivalent to a seizure of the property. And property, I don't think that, property
property's
is
not absolute.
Like that. It's not, but not only isn't it absolute, it's a bundle of rights.
Yeah.
And the bundle can be, it's a bunch of twigs in the bundle, and the bundle can be unbundled, and you can regulate some pieces of it and leave other pieces of it alone.
Well, let's talk about this in a minute, because I heard this thing from Rand Paul, and, you know,
yeah.
You're right. Yeah. I had a little bit of sympathy for Rand Paul when I heard it, and I'm black.
You know? Yeah, no, I know.
I like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and so forth, including the title that says about public accommodations that, you know, you have to rent your hotel room to people, and you got to serve them in your restaurant. I'm very happy about that part of the law. But what I thought, and in fact I heard George Will say this, I thought it was the smartest thing that I'd heard said about this, that the problem was not that Paul was incorrect in the observation, it was that it was an incomplete in a kind of politically, not in the electoral sense, but in the kind of deeper sense, stupid observation. Yes, we limited their rights for good and sufficient historical reason.
Yeah.
You know, yes, the state, in fact, rode roughshod over the absolute and unfettered right of private association in the context of Jim Crow segregation and a century of second-class citizenship for tens of millions of Americans.
That's what George Will said, and that's also what all the libertarians who are critical, the classical liberals and libertarians who were critical of Rand Paul said, is they said that the public accommodations provision of the Civil Rights Act was an appropriate response in the historical context to the evils of Jim Crow, which, by the way, they would then add, were evils that were perpetrated partly by the state. So this was the state correcting consequences of its own bad behavior through enforced racial segregation.
What's wrong with that? That's true.
The problem is that the public accommodations provision wasn't limited to race discrimination. So on this reconstruction of what was good, you know, what was fine about the public accommodations provision of the Civil Rights Act, it was really an overbroad and excessively sweeping requirement, because it didn't say, for example, it didn't say you have to serve African Americans who have been excluded as a consequence of state action, but it's okay to keep the Catholics out of your restaurant, or the Jews out of your restaurant, or the, you know, the Muslims out of your restaurant. So it was a much more sweeping prohibition on discrimination on grounds of religion
or ethnicity. But I don't understand how that defeats the previous point. It was sweeping.
Because it wasn't a remedy.
But it was also historically necessary, and it was a limitation of people's freedoms of association or absolute control over their property.
Yeah, no, that's right. But it wasn't simply a rectification for the state-imposed injustices of race discrimination.
Well, it went beyond that, but it never would have happened but for
It might not have happened but for, that may be fine. It may not happen but for, but it was a much more sweeping ban on discrimination on a variety of other grounds as well. And the thing is, yeah, it's true that on a certain conception of property. I mean, this is the, you know, what Rand Paul said is this is like nationalizing property. Well, I think that's ridiculous. It's only nationalizing property. I mean, nobody was telling the restaurants, you know, what kind of restaurant they had to be. They weren't seizing the assets of the restaurant. They weren't claiming, they weren't demanding to be the residual claimants on the restaurant's income.
So it takes
were saying, in this particular respect, there's a compelling justification for requiring that an accommodation of this kind not be complicit produce a system of discrimination.
But what I want to say is, whatever we might think about Rand Paul's use of the word, or mine, nationalization, that particular language, and we might think that's hyperbolic, that's excessive, that's not quite what this is. This is nothing like that. Still, the point that some diminution of freedom is a consequence of reasonable and historically necessary protections of the rights and the prerogatives of individuals defined by these various classifications of national identity or race or gender, sexual orientation, whatever it might be, that still remains the case. It remains the case that there is a tension between the freedom of individuals to act with respect to their own associations and the disposition of their own property to act in an unfettered manner, there's a diminution or a restriction on that freedom that attends ensuring that the social you know, landscape is open and accommodating of the you know, of the interest and of the aspirations of all people, regardless of their classification. So what's wrong as an intellectual matter with making the observation that freedom and equality in this particular sense are in some tension with one another? I mean, every time a politician belongs to a golf club or something that we find out did not have enough women, blacks, Jews, or whatever in it, and this, of course, this is not the court, this is not law or regulation, this is social opprobrium and the political consequences of it. But even so, every time such a case comes up, we are once again confronted with this conflict between freedom of association and the exercise of one's, you know, control over one's assets and such as one might like, on the one hand, and keeping a society open and equal to people who are defined according to these different classifications, other historical classifications that have a resonance and a meaning because of the particular history of this society. So anyway, end of speech. I'm still not convinced that Rand Paul basically wasn't right about the point, even if he was stupid about the politics of it.
Well, I'm losing a grip on exactly what the point is. I mean, it's true that every law we have, including laws, you know, criminal laws that criminalize murder, for example, those are restrictions on the choices of some people, namely the choices of people who are going to be murderers.
Okay.
Every tax law, including taxation for the provision of public goods, is a restriction on choices, requiring you to return. If you take some money from me, and you're required to return the money, that's a restriction on your choices. So I think a lot. This is a case where I think we're not aided by talking in sweeping abstractions about nationalization of property or taking people's property away. I think a lot depends on getting into the specifics of the issue. So in the case in point, I think if Rand Paul had said not that this was essentially the state taking away your property, if he had said this wasn't a matter of nationalizing your property, if he had said that this was a matter of restricting a very specific thing that you could do.
I've opened the store.
I don't want to serve
everybody who comes through the door. I have views about whom I'd like to serve in my restaurant, and my customers also have views about whom they'd like to eat with.
Right.
Now, to the extent that a law is enacted that restricts my ability to limit who comes into my restaurant and eats, and limit my ability to assure my customers that they will be eating without the company of people defined in some particular way, to the extent that the law inhibits me from doing that, it limits my freedom. I mean, that's not abstract. Yeah. That's really very concrete. Now, I'm saying appropriately limits your freedom in the case of race or sex, but I'm sure we can invent other categories of classifications of people. I could have a dress code, for example, about how I want people to be dressed in my restaurant, that would be entirely reasonable and consistent with the law. So so in the United States, because of our history, the acting on people's prejudices or discriminatory preferences along the lines of race, gender, national origin, sexual orientation, and so forth, has been prescribed by the law. It needn't have been, but it was. That was a historical event, and when it happened, it limited people's freedom to associate in a discriminatory way along those lines. They still do associate in discriminatory ways along their lines. They just don't do it in their public accommodations. They do it in the intimate spaces of their private lives, and they do it quite legally. So, again, I don't think that's too abstract. I think it's a limitation on freedom, a historically necessary limitation on freedom. And again, I give these other examples, not away from you know, the area of racial discrimination, where it seems to me that political realities and imperatives caused the government to act in ways that at least passively appropriate people's assets.
The reason that I'm having trouble with this, Glenn, is partly because, as I said before, every regulation that there is, including laws about murder and theft, restrict the choices that people are permitted to make. And the question is whether or not you have a good enough reason for doing that. That's what the issue is. Requiring people to pay taxes, including to pay taxes for the provision of public goods, is a restriction on the choices that people make. I'm not saying that that doesn't require justification. Of course, all of those things require justification. Yeah. But it seems to me that what you're invoking is the general fact that regulations require that regulations involve some restriction on people's choices, and I think that's a perfectly general thing. And then there are two questions that arise when you're trying to figure out whether those regulations are justified. One question is, what's the value in the name of which the justification is being in the name of which the regulation is being supported, and does that value rise to a sufficiently important level as to warrant the regulation? The other kind of inquiry that's conducted, and this does go back to the earlier thing that we were discussing about the protection of economic liberties in the first part of the
I'm not hearing
century.
You right now, Josh.
Yeah, sorry. I was saying that the I don't know when you cut out.
Just a moment ago.
Yeah. So, in addition to asking what's the value in the name of which the regulation is being justified, the other question is what kind of liberty is being regulated and how significant is that liberty? Is it so, for example, the principle in the first part of the 20th century by the Supreme Court's principle was that market liberties associated with, an unregulated labor market, for example, were on a par with political liberty and religious liberty, and that they required the same kind of compelling justification. The position that has really been the dominant position for about the past 70 years is that those kinds of liberties associated, for example, with an unregulated labor market don't have the importance and magnitude that requires the same kind of compelling justification as, for example, a restriction on freedom of speech or freedom of religion or political freedom. So I think it's important to talk about the values that are on the other side. That's one issue. And then the second issue is that I don't think that there's real merit. I don't think that there's real merit in talking about liberty in the abstract and whole cloth, as opposed to distinguishing between and among different kinds of liberties and judging what kind of significance they have when it comes to demanding protection.
Okay.
So that's what the ideas about fundamental liberties or basic liberties.
I don't find anything to take issue with in that. But may I return to my point about how here's how it seems
absolutely.
To me. It seems to me that these things like property and what you say is a bundle of rights. Okay.
Yes.
And these things like rights or freedom to do this or that.
Yeah,
they are abstract, but they're also contested, and they also evolve over time. And they are, historical products. So I observed about the oil spill. So the oil spill takes place. So, there are a bunch of companies involved, and I guess the courts will eventually sort out exactly who has what legal liability for losses entailed. I was wondering, for example, about the fact that they have leases, so the lessor, that is us, the people who were granting the lease to conduct this exploration offshore in this production, were earning, of course, royalties from the oils that were being produced, product that was being produced under the terms of the lease that had been granted. We're beneficiaries in some way, that is the people of the United States, to the extent that the petroleum company is paying these royalties from this production enterprise. We're kind of implicated, at least indirectly, in the chain of entailments and so forth that's going on there. Anyway, and the scale of the losses and the indirect character of the losses, right? You incur an economic loss because tourists don't come to the beach because they think that oil may be washing up on the shore. You might have otherwise had a business. You don't now have a business. The foregone earnings from the business that might have been are now on the table as a potential loss, along with actual oil that's sitting on people's property and other such, you know, so on and so forth. Anyway, not to make a long thing of this, the government then acts in that context, and it makes impositions and so on, sometimes through the courts, sometimes through the legislature, and sometimes through the discretion of the executive, which have real financial consequences for the company. And that just, you know, don't call it nationalization, don't call it expropriation, call it the, you know, sort of arbitrary limits on the property prerogatives of the people, or the ability to change those bundle of rights in ways that direct the flow of benefits one way or the other for political reasons. But so,
well, why do you say it's arbitrary? I mean,
because there's nothing objective. There's no objective determinant of what it should be. It's the outcome of a political. Maybe arbitrary again is not the right word, but in any case,
I'm just acting like some
objective criterion.
Maybe I'm just acting like a philosopher here, Glenn. But
making too much out of words.
But arbitrary, and you know, in my understanding, means it's something that you're doing without a reason. You know, nationalization has a meaning.
Okay, I want to problematize the reasons. So, I want to put the reasons up on the table and talk about them, because Hugo Chavez has his reasons too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the government in the Latin American country that has suffered 50 years of of mistreatment and you know, maluse by the imperial power, who then with populist sentiment at his back seizes the assets of the company, has his reasons too.
Yeah. There are a bunch of different, you know. There are a bunch of different issues, and you've laid out a bunch of them that you need to pay attention to in resolving a question like this.
Can I say something else?
I
just want to add one thing to this, because a reverse instance of the same point is the financial bailout.
Yeah.
And all of the huge rents that were generated for all of the parties and the counterparties and the third order counterparties of all of the complex financial transactions, who had their bacon saved by the taxpayers, by the ease of borrowing at the Federal Reserve from the discount window, by the we still don't even know the extent of all the transactions that were permitted under the auspices of the government's extraordinary fiscal protection in an emergency financial situation for people who might otherwise have gone belly up, but who didn't go belly up because they were able to unwind, reverse, liquidate, or otherwise cover positions that they might otherwise not have been able to cover because of the action of the state. Those were positive, not negative.
Yeah.
Their property was enhanced, not limited. But to the extent that people will now sit on top of $100 million or $1 billion of private property that they can alienate and dispose of pretty much in any way that they see fit, but which only exists because of the actions of political bodies within a particular historical circumstance, who acted with not arbitrary, they had their reasons, but there was nothing objectively correct or necessary about the particular actions that they took. And yet real people will cash actual checks in their pocket because of that. That was property created and distributed upward to the rich, I might add.
I'm confused by what you're saying. Listen, Glenn, I'm confused by what you're saying because it seems to me that you're saying two things that point in exactly the opposite direction.
Okay.
One is that you're invoking the idea of property and criticizing regulations that impinge on property as if property were something that were, you know, kind of natural and not legally and politically created. And on the other hand, you're invoking the fact that, you know, property rules, like all other rules, are politically enacted, and they're extremely complicated. And these two things seem to me to point in, well, okay, in different directions. I think in the settings that you're describing, there are two kinds of considerations that, very broadly speaking, two kinds of considerations that come into play. One is a set of backward-looking considerations where you try to sort out who's to blame. And that's true in the financial crisis. It's true with respect to the oil spill. And when you're trying to sort it out with respect to the oil spill, there are issues about BP, and there are also issues about the Department of the Interior and the ruination of the Department of the Interior, and whether that's the blame on the Bush administration, yeah, or the failures of the Obama administration to correct for that, yeah, is a something we can talk about. Anyway, there's a backward-looking set of considerations, which are very important. And then there are a forward-looking set of considerations about how you can solve a problem. Not just any solution to the problem is going to be okay. You can't solve the problem of the the oil spill by saying, "Gee, we're going to take care of unemployment in the Gulf region created by the oil spill by killing everybody there." I mean, there are some there's some non-solutions to the problem, and in the case of the financial bailout, there were people who said, "Look, you should let these firms go belly up. They should all go to jail. You should they should be subject to criminal sanction, the firms and people working in them." And maybe that may well be true. And then there was also a competing kind of consequentialist, forward-looking consideration, which is that the entire economy depends on the success of the financial sector, and you better get the financial sector unfrozen, or we're all going to be fucked.
Okay, Jeff.
Excuse my language.
Here's what I'm saying. I'm not saying two contradictory things. I'm saying the same thing. I'm saying both in the original case where I observed that I had some sympathy for Rand Paul's observation, and in these other cases, I'm saying I think the same thing. I had some sympathy for Rand Paul's observation only in the sense that I thought it was literally accurate to observe that it was a limitation on property. Not that I was celebrating or lionizing or thinking that somehow these property rights had to be absolute and sacrosanct, just to say that there was a limitation. And the thing that I'm trying to say through all of these cases is, I want to look at the actual at the real processes of power and legitimation that end up determining how these rights get respected and assigned and created and abrogated and limited and so on, and not think that this is just something that's happening. That I somehow think there's a deeper story. If I were a Marxian, right? I'm not. I might repair to that. I might repair to try to look at, but in any case, there's definitely in my critical observation here a kind of a postmodern sort of feel to it. There is the law, there are the legal structures. Here they are, what they are, and yet see them made before our very eyes and see them changed and transformed. Now let's remove the veil and look down underneath at the deeper structures of power, entitlement, the ability, the capacity to create and legitimate. And see what's really going on. There's somehow the fact that the bankers come out on top through the financial crisis, and that the wealth caches remain pretty much unassailed, strikes me as, that's not an accident. It's no accident. Yeah. Let's try to figure out what the deeper structure of the thing is.
Yeah.
Something like that, Josh.
Yeah, so here's the difference between what we're saying. I'm all for trying to figure out whose ox is getting gored, whose interests are being advanced, who are the winners, who are the losers, what are the deeper structures of legitimation,
right,
how is power at work. But then there's another question, which is not a question. It's not a social science question. It's a normative question. The normative question is, okay, so what ought to happen? what's the right answer to the question? Or what are the family of right answers to the question? So in the case of your observation about Rand Paul, when you said, and I suppose I did partially misunderstand the target of your sympathy, you said you were sympathetic to him. I agree with you that it's a correct observation to make that the public accommodations provision of the Civil Rights Act is a restriction on choices that people can make who own restaurants. It seems hard to deny that, just like putting murderers in jail is a restriction on the choices of murderers. The question is whether it's a good, whether it's a warranted restriction or an unwarranted restriction.
Of course, I agree.
And I misunderstood the sympathy, because I thought you were saying that the sympathy extended to your thinking that maybe there was a good case for the point that he was making,
no,
as opposed to the descriptive observation.
No, it's a warranted...
What I'm troubled about in what you're describing, I think maybe rightly, as you know, the postmodern sensibility that's expressed in your remarks, is that I don't think, after you've made all those observations, that the normative question goes away. And I don't think you think that either. And I'm trying to focus on the...
We agreed about
question.
That. We agreed that the normative question, at least in the case of anti-discrimination law, was rightly decided by the legislature and the courts as we've developed this doctrine.
Right.
I don't question that for a moment. Historically necessary, the right thing to do. Let me give another example of mystification. It's the Afghanistan policy.
Yeah.
I wonder if the president is in charge of it. I understand that he's the commander in chief, and I saw him remove a lion-eyed, celebrated military commander from his responsibilities because of, in effect, insubordination, or at least conduct that was inconsistent with, you know, good order and discipline in the ranks.
Yeah. By the way, just a footnote here: insubordination, conduct inconsistent, blah 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 blah. And just for the historical record, hardly the first time that McChrystal had done that kind of thing. I mean, he basically made a public announcement back when the policy was being ramped up that he wouldn't go along with Vice President Biden's...
Josh, okay.
I mean, this guy, so he got the royal suck-up treatment when he was put in command from, as Sarah Palin calls it, the lamestream media. But, you know, McChrystal, this was not... That McChrystal did this was not a shock, given
Josh,
his previous record.
Let
anyway,
me make
go
my
ahead.
Point. He
go
said,
ahead.
He,
I'm all ears, Glenn.
Now, he said publicly that he was disappointed with the president. That's what I heard. I heard that he said he went into a meeting in the White House with the president and that he was disappointed.
Yeah.
And I'm observing in the aftermath. Here's what I'm wondering, and I just don't know. I've never been in the Situation Room when the president has sat down with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and so on. I'm wondering who's really in charge, and I'm wondering when we get away from the formal titular order of prerogative and structure of power, and we get down to the actual de facto meaningful structures and power, whether or not the president has nearly as much control over these situations as we comfort ourselves thinking that he does. And I'm wondering whether, in fact, as the months go ahead and we reach the middle and the end of 2011, on the ground in Afghanistan, there's going to be the withdrawal, or whether or not there's not. Whether or not, in fact, the policy that the president has stated and reiterated on more than one occasion is going to get carried out. And if it does not get carried out, I'm going to be wondering at that time whether or not, in some sense, the military actually did what they wanted to do, not what the president was elected with the idea that he wanted to do. I'm wondering if he can really have his way. Am I crazy to think that? I'm sort of thinking, you know, he came into office and he was really very clear. We're going to get out of Afghanistan. I'm wondering whether or not it's going to happen.
I thought that... there are two points that I want to make here. First of all, I think this question, is he really in charge? You know, de facto, does the de facto situation match the lines of command responsibility, you know, to match the, you know, the organizational charts with the commander in chief at the top. I of course not. Generally, there isn't unilateral decision making power. There may be whatever the authority is. So I'm not surprised that you know, it's that the policy in Afghanistan is not just all the unfolding of Obama's wishes, but more substantively, Obama was elected as a critic of the policy in Iraq, and all along was distinguishing between Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, Afghanistan for Obama was always sort of the good war, and I do think that there was a real decision point. It was a decision point that was not taken by the military. It was undertaken by the president, which was a decision to decide to escalate, to do a surge in Afghanistan like the surge in Iraq. And that decision could have gone the other way. That's the kind of thing where presidential authority, I think, does make a difference. And I think it did make a difference there. Biden had a different position. Obama decided not to go down Biden's route. There are plenty of critics around of the idea of a surge in Afghanistan. There were people who said, people who were saying, look, the surge in Iraq worked. Here are the reasons why the surge in Iraq worked. Those reasons don't apply to the case of Afghanistan. Yeah. And I think there was a decision. I think Obama made that decision. It was not a shocking decision given what he had said in the campaign and as a critic of the Iraq war.
The decision had two parts, right? It was, yes, that we were going to increase by 30,000 the number of troops there in a counterintelligence-oriented campaign, but that we were also going to begin a definitive drawdown of our forces beginning on a date certain in 2011. And those were kind of balancing components of the decision. And I'm just wondering whether or not that second part about the drawdown, which I thought was a very important balance to the surge and then drawdown really going to, was it window dressing? Was it something that was necessary in order to accommodate the president's insistence that we had to begin to get out, but that the people like General McChrystal knew all the time could be gamed in some way or another? I don't know. This sounds a little conspiratorial.
A little too conspiratorial for me because I think you're giving Obama too much credit here. For whatever reasons, he said that there was going to be a drawdown by date certain. First of all, there was a lot of waffling on whether this was exactly a drawdown by with a certain date, and I wouldn't be surprised if. That drawdown date is drawn out, and I wouldn't be surprised about that given Obama's position on Afghanistan all along, and also given the fact that that war is not going particularly well, and not going particularly well for reasons that people who are critical of the surge in Afghanistan predicted. The situation in Afghanistan is not the same as the situation in Iraq. But I wouldn't regard that, I wouldn't think that the conspiratorial part, and I do think it's too conspiratorial, is that this reflects that, you know, that Obama got suckered by McChrystal or, you know, got suckered by the military. I mean, Obama's, as you know, is a brilliant guy. He was hearing, I'm sure, when he made this decision, that a counterinsurgency strategy in Afghanistan was by no means a certain success, and if McChrystal or somebody said, I can guarantee you that a counterinsurgency policy in Afghanistan is going to be successful, and you'll be able to start to announce the withdrawal of troops midway through 2011. And celebrate the success of this Afghan. And I can tell you that for certain. If McChrystal said that and Obama believed it and made the policy on that, then Obama's to blame for that, not the person who said it.
Yeah, I got a bridge I want to sell you.
But of course, McChrystal didn't. Nobody said that. Right. And if anybody said it, Obama wouldn't have believed it. If you had asked Obama at the time, is this a certain success? Of course, he would have said it's not a certain success. If you had asked him if it's not being successful at the time that we're saying that we're going to draw down the forces, are we going to draw them down anyway? I'm sure he would have said we'll fall off that bridge if and when we come to it. Was he going to say that in public? No. And to the extent that your concern is about a disparity between public statement and what's really going on behind closed doors, that's a fair point.
I just wonder about it. I mean, another thing that resonated with me was their contempt for Jim Jones. Former General James Jones, National Security Advisor, because 6 months ago I read Leslie Gelb say exactly the same thing. Not he didn't call him a clown, but he had contempt for James Jones, who he said was not the brightest bulb in the room as far as giving some kind of independent direction to the president's foreign policy. That was Leslie Gelb. Former head of the Council on Foreign Relations and, longtime defense reporter for the New York Times, foreign affairs reporter before that, who was saying that. So it's just like these are all like tea leaves or whatever, because here I am sitting out here with a modem basically trying to figure out what's going on in the world. But I just wonder, if there isn't a story behind or underneath the story about the extent to which the president has command over the apparatus of military and security affairs in the country.
It's the reason that we're in the business that we're in is because we take a question like, is the president in command? And we say, the first thing we say is, you gotta break down that question a little bit. So my way of breaking down that question is I say, there was a decision point about escalating this war, decision point about having a surge. I think that was a choice that was the president's. I think he could have gone either way on it. And he made a decision to go one way rather than the other on it. I'm sure there are lots of numbnuts in the administration. There were people who were saying that when McChrystal was appointed, that McChrystal was basically a kind of showboater. There was this ass-kissing exercise that the lamestream media went through. He was all lionized, and I'm sure when people tell the story with 2020 hindsight about McChrystal's role, they'll discover all the ways in which he's, not a blunderbuss like James Jones, but all the downsides of him that they weren't saying when he was appointed in the first place, when all they could talk about was his exercise regimen and his diet and his Zen style. So, I'm sure there are, General Jones, maybe a dopey guy. Was McChrystal a dopey guy for shooting off his mouth to Rolling Stone? Was he setting up Rolling Stone for extricating him as a strategy for extricating himself from a job that he didn't want to?
I've got all kinds of conspiracy theories running around in my head about that one. I can't believe he could be just so stupid as to spout off without a deeper plan, but
here's a last point on this. We should break it up. But when I hear these statements, like he must have had a deeper plan. I mean, didn't he realize how this was going to play out? I have two responses to that. The first thing is that the Rolling Stone reporter who wrote the story said that he himself was very surprised by the impact that the story had. Okay, that's a minor point. But, the general premise behind McChrystal says this stuff, and he must have, didn't he know that this was all going to come out, and didn't he know that the effect that this was going to have? I mean, people do say all sorts of stuff and do all sorts of dopey stuff that gets them in a lot of trouble. And you always ask the question, well, didn't they realize that? Didn't Al Gore realize that somebody was going to snitch on him for being that a masseuse was going to snitch
didn't
on him
John
for being
Edwards,
an asshole?
Didn't John Edwards realize that all that stuff was going to
Didn't
come
John
out?
Edwards realize? Didn't Bill Clinton realize?
Okay.
So John Edwards really didn't want to be president. That's why he was. You know, Al Gore really wanted global warming. That's why he was acting that way, and he thought he would discredit himself. Bill Clinton didn't want the Democrats to win in 2000. That's why he couldn't keep his pants on. I mean, these kind of, these views are sort of
Josh,
ridiculous.
You're talking
so
into
giving
it.
McChrystal more credit.
I withdraw the comment. I apologize.
Okay.
We've been talking for an hour, Josh. We didn't get to what we were supposed to talk about, but that's okay.
That's all right. Life is like that. Yeah. Good to talk as ever.
Okay, listen, I'm going to Bogota for a couple of weeks, and when I come back, I'm going to have lots of conspiracy theories about inequality in Latin America, about race and the Afro-Colombians and the indigenous people, about police states, right-wing militias, narco-trafficking, and the U.S. International Drug Interdiction Policy. So we have to talk about that.
They're not going to be – all those conspiracy theories are going to be true. We'll talk about it when you get back. Very good to talk.
Right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.